A poor old man owned a beautiful and powerful white stallion. The king offered this poor man a small fortune to purchase the horse, but the old guy declined. That particular winter, it was brutal. The man and his family almost starved to death. The townspeople came to the old man and they said, "Why don't you sell your stallion? You'll be rich. You'll no longer have to worry about money. To not sell is to play the fool." Well, the poor old man responded, "Well, it's too early to tell." A few months later, the old fellow woke up and he found that the white stallion had ran away. Well, when the townsfolk heard the news, they came to the old man and they scoffed at him. They said, "See, if you had sold your horse to the king, you'd be rich. But now you have nothing. You're a fool." Well, the poor old man replied, "It's too early to tell." Well, 2 weeks later, the stallion returned with three more stallions. Well, the townspeople apologized. They said, "We're the fools now. You can sell your white stallion to the king and still have three beautiful stallions." The old man told them, he said, "Yeah, but it's really too early to tell if that would have been wise." Well, the following week, the old man's son, his only son, was breaking in one of the stallions when it threw him off. The fall crushed his legs. And the townsfolk rebuked him, said, "Old man, if you'd sold that stallion to the king, you'd be rich and your son wouldn't be crippled. You're a fool." The old man told them, said, "Well, it's too early to tell." Well, the following month, a war broke out. All the town's young men were drafted and sent into battle except this old man's crippled son. Well, sadly, the rest of the town's sons died on the battlefield. The grieving town confided in the old man, "We've lost our sons. Your boy's the only one alive. If you had sold your stallion to the king, he too would have died in the war. You're a smart man." And that's when the old man answered, "Well, it's just too early to tell." And at any point in the story of Joseph, someone could have commented on the good or bad fortune that had befallen him and drawn a conclusion. But it would have been too early to tell. For life is full of ups and downs, and God has purposes for both. It's always too early to tell until the whole story has been written. The roller coaster ride known as Joseph's life is an amazing story. But the overarching lesson it teaches is the overarching of the providence of God in our lives. God does make all things beautiful in His time. The problem, though, is that His time is not always our time. There were times in Joseph's situation that seemed cruel and unfair. It didn't make sense. He was a good man, snake bit by bad circumstances. How many days was he tempted to doubt God's faithfulness and question God's love? How often did he stare into the darkness of despair and beg God to shine his light? And yet all that happened to Joseph turned out to have a grand purpose. The twists and the turns that God engineered not only fulfilled God's plan, but along the way fashioned Joseph into the man that God needed him to be. As Joseph will say to his brothers today in Genesis 50, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." The welfare of Egypt and its neighboring nations, the survival of Israel's family, reconciliation with his brothers, the growth of the Hebrew people, the preservation of the Messianic line, ultimately the salvation of the world hung on how Joseph's life unfolded. Who would have thunk it as Joseph went through it? At any point, it would have been too early to tell. Well, chapter 48 begins. "Now it came to pass after these things that Joseph was told, 'Indeed, your father is sick.' And he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim." Joseph wants his dad to bless his sons. "And Jacob was told, 'Look, your son Joseph is coming to you.' And Israel strengthened himself and sat up on the bed. Then Jacob said to Joseph, 'God Almighty appeared to me at Luz.'" You remember the account at Bethel where he saw the ladder extending into heaven. in the land of Canaan and blessed me and said to me, behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make of you a multitude of people and give this land to your descendants after you as an everlasting possession. Jacob, or Israel as God renamed him, is recalling the Abrahamic covenant. Hope you remember that covenant. It's the most important in the Bible. Genesis 12 talks about how God promised Abram and his heirs three things: sod, seed, and salvation. He promised Abram a tract of land, offspring or a great nation, and a blessing that would come through that nation. This is the covenant that defines the Middle East to this very day. It was first made to Abraham, then confirmed to Isaac, then to Jacob or Israel, and then finally to his 12 sons, as we'll see here. Now, Israel is dying, and Joseph brings his two boys to their grandfather for a blessing. In a patriarchal society, the paternal blessing was a big deal. The father, or the senior family member, was poised to pass on a sense of vision and legacy to younger family members. It helped children and grandchildren to see the bigger picture for the family, to have a generational purpose for his offspring. I think modern people and families have lost a lot by not structuring for and valuing this paternal blessing. Well, Jacob here, he says to Joseph, and now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, are mine, as Reuben and Simeon. They shall be mine. Your offspring whom you beget after them shall be yours and will be called by the name of their brothers in their inheritance. Now, I'm sure this was unexpected. It went past just the giving of a blessing. For Jacob here officially adopts Manasseh and Ephraim, Joseph's boys, thus giving him a family of 13 tribes. Joseph is replaced by his two sons. But it's fascinating, whenever the Bible speaks of the tribes of Israel, and it often does, there are always how many? 12, never 13. It's sort of a shell game, really. Different lists, we'll find, leave out different tribes for different reasons, but there are always 12. Well, here, Joseph gets replaced by his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Israel continues. But as for me, when I came from Padan, Rachel died beside me in the land of Canaan on the way. You remember, Rachel was his beloved wife, and he's remembering her now. When there was but a little distance to go to Ephrath, and I buried her there on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. Rachel was also Joseph's mom. And Jacob is thinking back on Rachel as he speaks to Joseph. Verse 8. Then Israel saw Joseph's sons and said, who are these? Apparently he was nearly blind. And Joseph said to his father, they are my sons whom God has given me in this place. And he said, please bring them to me and I will bless them. Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age so that he could not see. And then Joseph brought them near him and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, I had not thought to see your face, but in fact, God has also shown me your offspring. This blew Jacob's mind. He didn't think he'd ever see Joseph again. He thought he was dead. But God has allowed him to not only see his son, but to also see his two grandsons. What a blessing indeed. And so Joseph brought them from beside his knees, and he bowed down with his face to the earth. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near him. Now, Joseph knows that his father is blind as a bat. And so he lines up his son according to the anticipated blessings. The older son, Manasseh, is positioned in front of Jacob's right hand, his hand of preference. And the younger son, Ephraim, is in front of dad's left hand. Joseph is complying with the customary birthright. We've talked about it before, the law of primogeniture Remember, in antiquity, family preeminence went to the older sibling over the younger sibling. Joseph, though, didn't realize that his family doesn't always follow custom. Verse 14. Then Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. Note this wise old man knows exactly what he's doing. He swaps his hands and he exalts the younger over the older. And he blessed Joseph and said, God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. Let my name be named upon them in the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. This blessing is going to shape their lives and their offspring forever. Now, when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. So he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head. I mean, Joseph, he values order and custom, and especially with this important blessing. But his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He, that is the firstborn Manasseh, also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. But truly this younger brother, Ephraim, shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. And so he blessed them that day, saying, by you Israel will bless, saying, may God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh. Notice how Israel lists the brothers. He places the younger Ephraim first, then the older Manasseh. And thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. And note, this was not a small matter in the eyes of God. For what Israel does here earns him a place in God's hall of faith. Hebrews chapter 11. If you go to Hebrews 11 and look in verse 21, it sums up Genesis 48 by saying, by faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshiped, leaning on the top of his staff. Jacob crossed his hands to bless the boys, and he blessed the younger son over the older. And in so doing, the writer of Hebrews says he worshiped God. I'm sure in his mind, Jacob was recalling God's grace toward him, for he too was the younger son. Yet he had been blessed above his older brother Esau. You know, one of the peculiarities of all three Hebrew patriarchs is that the law of firstborn was violated in their families. Abraham loved Isaac above the older son Ishmael. Isaac blessed Jacob over the older brother Esau. And now Jacob, or Israel, blesses Ephraim over Manasseh. See, this was God's way of saying that his favor is not awarded according to natural advantage or according to social endowments or earthly custom or the traditions of men, but by grace through faith. See, God upsets human power structures and human expectations, and he bestows favor on the unexpected. The last shall be first. This means if you're the run of the litter, if you feel unwanted or passed over or unqualified, then you need to take heart. For God crosses his hands at the cross of Jesus Christ. And through the sacrifice of his son, he has chosen to bestow his greatest blessings on the least deserving. That includes you and me. Well, verse 21, then Israel said to Joseph, behold, I am dying, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given to you one portion above your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and my bow. And the question becomes, when did Jacob ever go to war with the Amorites? Well, we really don't know. Genesis doesn't say. But it's not unreasonable to think he had a skirmish or two along the way. Here, though, Israel points out that this blessing on the grandsons, Manasseh and Ephraim, actually doubles Joseph's share of the family blessing. It's another coat of many colors. One last special gift from Jacob to his favorite son, Joseph. Well, in chapter 49, Jacob then blesses all 12 sons. He's in the spirit now. He's peering off into the future. And he begins prophesying over each son and the tribe that will come from his lineage. Some of his words here are sort of tough to swallow. They're more curses than blessings. As we'll see, Jacob doles out a few prophecies that are hard pills to swallow. Well, verse 1 begins. And Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days. Gather together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel, your father." Now remember, Jacob is on his deathbed. All his sons have now gathered to him. Suddenly his bedroom becomes a courtroom. He begins with the oldest. "Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power, but unstable as water, you shall not excel." Water always flows to the lowest point, doesn't it? And sadly, this was Reuben's history. Over and over, rather than rise up spiritually, Reuben tended to gravitate toward the lowest point morally. And here's the most horrible example. He says, "Because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch." Genesis 35, verse 22 recounts the story of Reuben committing incest with Bilhah, his father's concubine, a sin that cost Reuben dearly. His lust and his indiscretion cost him his potential. Reuben forfeited the rights of the firstborn. He will not excel. Reuben's future descendants end up not even entering the promised land. When General Joshua brings Israel back to the land of Canaan, the tribe of Reuben settles for a spot east of the Jordan River. They don't even cross over into the land. Still later, Reuben becomes the first tribe scattered by the Assyrians. It was downhill from here for Reuben. Well, verse 5, "Simeon and Levi are brothers, instruments of cruelty are in their dwelling place." Recall Genesis 34. These brothers led the brutal slaughter of the men of Shechem. And they teach us a lesson of how uncontrolled anger can cost us greatly. If you have an anger problem, man, you need to see someone quick. You need to get some help. Uncontrolled anger can tear up a family. Jacob says, "Let not my soul enter their council. Let not my honor be united to their assembly. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." And this becomes prophetic. Levi ends up becoming the priestly tribe. And rather than being given a portion of land like his brothers, he gets scattered throughout the cities, throughout all of the nation. Simeon blends in with the southernmost tribe of Judah. Both Levi and Simeon are ultimately divided and scattered, just as Jacob here predicts. Well, verse 8, "Judah, you are he whom your brothers shall praise." And recall the word Judah means praise. "Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you." Now, Judah will ultimately receive his father Israel's birthright. Judah will be given the status of the firstborn. Reuben forfeited it. Levi and Simeon were unworthy. It falls to Judah. Judah will be given the status of preeminence among his brothers and in the family. His tribe will bear the royal line. For he says, Judah is a lion's whelp from the prey. My son, you have gone up. He bows down, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who shall rouse him? Israel depicts Judah here as a lion. And from this idiom, Messiah gets his nickname, the Lion of the Tribe of Judah. Our Lord Jesus descended from this particular tribe of Judah. And verse 10 records a fascinating prophecy concerning Judah. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the people. This word Shiloh can be interpreted, he whose right it is. And since the ultimate right to the throne of God's kingdom belongs to the Messiah of the tribe of Judah, the rabbis always took Shiloh to be another name for the Messiah. This prophecy says that the scepter was a symbol of the king's right to rule. It was commonly associated with the practice of capital punishment. We're told here that the scepter, or this right to self-rule, would not pass from the kingdom of Judah until Messiah had come. Yet the Romans stripped the Jews of this right in 7 AD, when Judea was made a Roman province. You remember 25 years later in 32 AD, when the Sanhedrin wanted to have Jesus executed. You remember they couldn't do it themselves. They actually had to go to the Roman governor, to Pilate, to get his approval. They no longer had the right to execution or the right to self-rule. And this right of self-governance was taken, when it was taken away, the Babylonian Talmud records the Jewish response. Apparently, when it happened, the rabbis all came out and they cried, "Woe unto us, for the scepter has been taken from Judah and the Messiah has not appeared." You see, in the Israeli mind, Jacob's prophecy in Genesis 49 had failed. The scepter had passed and there was no Messiah. But what the rabbis didn't realize was that Shiloh had come. For at that very moment in 7 AD, Jesus, the Messiah, was 12 years old. He was working in his father's carpenter shop in Nazareth. You remember, he might have already visited the temple as a 12-year-old. Remember when he was about his father's business. Shiloh had come. They just didn't realize it. Well, this prophecy concerning Judah continues. Binding his donkey to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine, he washed his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine and his teeth whiter than milk. This prophecy also concerns Messiah's coming, but not his first, like the former, but his second coming. Remember the Bible's prophetic passages, Isaiah 63, as well as Revelation 14 and 19, picture Jesus treading the winepress, judging the nations, and coming up from Bozrah, from the south, with a robe splattered in the blood of the rebels that he slayed in battle. One day Jesus will return, bring judgment upon God's enemies. Now, in Genesis' earlier chapters, Judah had failed miserably. You remember the story of Judah and Tamar. But thankfully, people can change. Aren't you glad? At one time, Judah was lust-filled and self-absorbed, but his willingness to sacrifice himself for Benjamin showed his repentance, and God forgave him. And according to Genesis 49, God is going to use Judah to bring about Messiah and his kingdom. Verse 13, Zebulun shall dwell by the haven of the sea. He shall become a haven for ships, and his border shall adjoin Sidon. Now, in the Old Testament, the territory of Zebulun was landlocked. It was right in the heart of the Galilee. Therefore, this must be speaking of the end times. Apparently, in the kingdom age, Zebulun will become a commercial port. It'll extend to the sea. It'll become a trading partner with its northern neighbors. And then Jacob foresees the future of the tribe of Issachar, verse 14. Issachar is a strong donkey lying down between two burdens. He saw that rest was good and that the land was pleasant. So he bowed his shoulder to bear a burden and became a band of slaves. Now, you've heard of the Georgia Bulldogs. You've heard of the Georgia Tech Yellow Jackets. Well, here are the Issachar strong donkeys. This tribe was mighty. They were endowed with numbers and with resources. They had great potential. When the nation returned to the land, it should have been easy for Issachar to drive out the Canaanites. But in the end, they became a band of slaves. For the strong donkeys had a problem, a weakness. They were lazy. Jacob sees them lying between two loads. Rather than lifting the load, they're lying down in front of the load. One of the potential problems every Christian faces is laziness. You know, it's been said, we can't do God's part, but God won't do our part. The stories of Genesis about the patriarchs of God's family all teach us that our part in our covenant with God is faith. But understand, faith is not a passive thing. It's aggressive. It requires effort and diligence. See, to grow in your faith, you have to apply yourself to God's word, and you have to apply God's word to your life. And renewing your mind requires a concentrated effort. You've got to replace old assumptions with new truth. It takes some brain drain to rethink unbiblical ideas and change the way we approach situations. That's why the Christian life takes effort. And lazy believers end up like the Issachar strong donkeys, a band of slaves. When you get lazy, you become a slave to sin or a slave to your own fleshly desires. It's been said, laziness grows on people. It begins in cobwebs and ends in iron chains. If you don't work at shaking it off, it ensnares you. Well, the prophecies continue, verse 16. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, a viper by the path that bites the horse's heels so that its rider shall fall backward. I have waited for your salvation, O Lord. The tribe of Dan was like a poisonous snake. He bites Israel and injects the venom of idolatry. You remember one of the two golden calves that later contaminated the northern kingdom of Israel was set up within the borders of Dan. Well, then Gad, a troop shall tramp upon him, but he shall triumph at last. Gad was an army that will experience both victory and defeat. Ultimately, he'll prevail. Later, this was the tribe that supplied troops for King David. Bread from Asher shall be rich. Asher was the land below Mount Carmel in the north. Even today, it's fertile farmland. It is rich land. And he shall yield royal dainties or live in luxury. But this phrase can be interpreted, he will dip his foot in oil. And today it's interesting that the port of Haifa is in the borders of Asher. Haifa is actually the terminal point for the pipelines that bring petroleum down to Israel. So he will dip his foot in oil. Naphtali is a deer let loose. Like a wild deer, this tribe liked its isolation and independence. Naphtali bordered on the Sea of Galilee, where Jesus did most of his teaching, and thus Naphtali uses beautiful words, he says. Verse 22, Joseph is a fruitful bow, a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. Joseph will be like a bulging cluster of grapes or prosperous. Ephraim and Manasseh, Joseph's sons, end up the two most populous tribes. Then Jacob says of Joseph, the archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. And boy, for the first 30 years of his life, Joseph was a target for all kinds of deceit and attacks and calamities. But his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. And I love this. I pray this for myself, that my hands will be made strong by God's hands. That's a good prayer to pray. For there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel, by the God of your father, who will help you. Jesus is the shepherd and the stone of Israel. Shepherd speaks of his first coming, and stone epitomizes his second coming. And by the Almighty, who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breasts and of the wound. In other words, all of life's blessings are going to come upon you, Joseph. The blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. As Jacob's blessing exceeded his ancestors, Abraham and Isaac, Joseph's blessing will exceed the blessings of Jacob. Joseph will be fruitful and strong and blessed by God. And then verse 27, Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall divide the spoil. And if you have a daughter at home, here's some good advice for you. Don't you dare let her date a Benjamite. I'm telling you. I'm warning you. Benjamin was Joseph's little brother, the son of Rachel, but his ancestors become like wolves. The cruelty of the Benjamites is well documented in Judges chapters 19 and 20. If you got a daughter at home, you better read Judges chapter 19 and 20, especially if she comes home with somebody named Benjamin. Boy. Well, Jacob wraps up his paternal and prophetic insights. He says, all these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father spoke to them. And he blessed them. He blessed each one according to his own blessing. Then he charged them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron the Hittite as a possession for a burial place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is there were purchased from the sons of Heth. And this is a marvelous statement. Whenever I read it, I'm amazed. Rather than be buried next to his beloved wife, Rachel, the good-looking one, in Bethlehem, Jacob desires to be buried forever in Mamre next to Leah. Oh, lizard lips Leah. The ugly gal. Now recall, in the beginning, on their wedding night, Jacob resented lying next to ugly Leah. Remember, he felt double-crossed by his father-in-law Laban. But you see, over the years, he grew attached to Leah. They formed a bond. And Jacob ended up loving ugly Leah every bit as much as he formerly loved the beautiful Rachel. And why? For love grows when you honor your marriage vows and you learn to love your spouse the way God wants you to love them. See, we all need to love our Leah. And when Jacob had finished commanding his sons, he drew his feet up into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. That's an interesting way of saying Jacob died. And note the reference here to the afterlife. He was gathered to his people. Obviously, his people were still alive. They were just on the grave's other side. Well, chapter 50. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. Now realize the Egyptians were famous for inventing an embalming process called mummification. And this is where it's going to get a little morbid. But here's how it worked. Well, first, the brains were removed by taking a crooked wire and inserting it up into the nose. Second, an incision in the fanny flank allowed for the removal of the vital organs, the insides. Third, the body was washed outside with water and inside with palm wine. Fourth, the head of the person and the abdominal cavities were stuffed with myrrh and cinnamon and other aromatic spices. Fifth, the body was soaked for 40 days in a solution of salt water. Sixth, the body was wrapped with strips of cloth as long as 700 feet. The strips were smeared with gum and cooked onto the body with extreme heat. I told you it's going to get a little morbid. Seventh, cloth layers plastered on the inside with lime were wrapped around the body, forming a hard encasement. And then a mask was made to resemble the person's face. I suppose you could say that, like all Egyptian fathers, Jacob was a daddy who became a mummy. And while I'm here, let me throw in a few mummy jokes. There's only one thing better than a good dad joke, and that's a mummy joke. You ready? You ready for this? Name a holiday in Egypt. How about Mummy's Day? You got the same sense of humor I do. It's a curse. Why do mummies have trouble making friends? They're too wrapped up in themselves. What kind of music do mummies like? Oh, come on. Rap music, yeah. Or ragtime, how about that? What kind of briefs does a mummy wear? Fruit of the tomb. Why don't mummies take vacations? They're afraid to relax and unwind. Yeah. If a mummy gives you $2 for a quarter, what just happened? You got Egypt. Egypt. You got Egypt. And finally, where do mummies swim? Of course, the Dead Sea. Yeah. And to all of the fathers here today, when you die, you won't be a daddy. You won't be a mummy, but you will be a memory. You will be. You won't be mummified, but we all will get memorialized. Your memory will be preserved, Dad. And here's the question. What kind of impression are you leaving? What kind of a legacy are you giving to your kids? Notice verse 3. 40 days were required of him, for such are the days required for those who are embalmed. And the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. Notice they mourned for Jacob 70 days. That's a 2-month funeral. And I think it's cruel the way modern society mourns 2 or 3 days for a loved one and then expects everybody to go back to work on Monday. Just resume life as if nothing major has happened to us. Well, life goes on. But I don't think God designed the human heart to heal from a loss in 2 or 3 days. Yes, life goes on, but at times we can't until we take time to mourn and purge ourselves of our grief. We need to give ourselves time to turn loose of the person that we love. Here it's interesting. They mourn for Jacob 7 long weeks. Verse 4, and when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, if now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the hearing of Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, behold, I am dying. In my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me. Now, therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, and I will come back. And Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father as he made you swear. So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as all the house of Joseph, his brothers, and his father's house. Only their little ones, their flocks, and their herds they left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great gathering. Joseph leads his entourage to the land of Canaan. He arranges a state funeral with a full military escort. Verse 10, then they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, and they mourned there with a great and very solemn lamentation. He observed 7 days of mourning for his father. And when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, this is a deep mourning of the Egyptians. Therefore, its name was called Abel Mizraim, literally the mourning of Egypt, which is beyond the Jordan. And so his sons did for him just as he had commanded them, for his sons carried him to the land of Canaan. His sons served as his pallbearers. And they buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite as property for a burial place. And this was the only parcel that a Hebrew ever purchased in the land that God had promised them. And after he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers and all who went up with him to bury his father. In other words, Joseph and his friends finally had to go back to work. And there does come a point where life goes on. We have to move on. Reminds me of last night at the Georgia football game. Stadium was packed. I mean, you know, it was packed to the gills, SEC championship, except for one seat. Did you notice it? It was on the 50-yard line. There was one seat. There was a female Dogs fan sitting there next to this one lone, conspicuously empty seat. Well, someone asked her, said, why is this seat empty? She replied, she said, well, this was my husband's seat. We always attended the games together, but he died recently. Well, the fellow said, my, that's so sad. But why couldn't you get another family member to take his place? She replied, she said, well, no one was available. Everybody but me was at his funeral. Now, that might be getting back to normal just a little too soon. But at some point, you got to move on. Verse 15. Well, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him. With Jacob dead, Joseph's brothers get worried. Maybe the only reason Joseph has been nice to us and forgave us of all that we've done to him was for dad's sake. Maybe he's going to grow fangs. And so they sent messengers to Joseph saying, before your father died, he commanded saying, thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. Now please forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. And I'm sure it broke Joseph's heart to think that his brothers doubted his love for them and didn't trust in his forgiveness. You know, it breaks God's heart when we doubt his love for us and that he died for our forgiveness. Sadly here, these brothers assume that Joseph will turn on them the way they had turned on him. Then his brothers also went and fell down before his face, and they said, behold, we are your servants. And Joseph said to them, do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? I'm nobody's judge, he says. But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive. Now therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Never forget, the story of Joseph teaches us that the key to our overcoming life's bitterness is a strong trust in God's providence. From the pit to Potiphar's to the prison to the palace, at any point along the way, God could have stepped in and rescued Joseph from his troublesome circumstances, but he didn't. It was too early to tell. And there was one more P to go with Joseph's comings and goings. It was perfecting. For God's purpose was not just to position Joseph's career, but to perfect Joseph's character. God uses our circumstances not just to position us, but to perfect us. For he's concerned with both where we need to be, but even more importantly, who we need to be when we get there. Verse 22. So Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation. The children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were also brought up on Joseph's knees. And Joseph said to his brethren, I am dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land of which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. And Joseph makes the same request as his dad. He wants his bones returned to the land God promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And we'll read in Exodus 13, verse 19, that 300 years later, Moses and the Hebrews will comply with this request, and they will exit Egypt with the bones of Joseph. And it's interesting, of all the exploits that could have gotten Joseph into the Bible's Hall of Faith, Hebrews 11, the one that's mentioned is his command concerning dim bones. Hebrews 11, verse 22, by faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. Notice this, despite his faithfulness to God, his purity, his moral courage, his wise oversight, his forgiving spirit, he gets special mention because of his faith in God's covenant. Joseph believes that God promised them the land that they were to possess. Hey, God values our purity and our courage and our devotion. But remember, it is faith alone which makes you and me right with God. Faith. We need to ask God to build our faith. Genesis closes. So Joseph died being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. John Phillips writes, thus ends Genesis. It begins with creation and ends with a coffin. It begins with glory and ends with a grave. It begins with the vastness of eternity and ends with the shortness of time. It begins with the living God and ends with a dead man. It begins with a blaze of brightness in heaven and ends with a box of bones in Egypt. That is the Holy Spirit's final comment in this book on the nature and tragedy of human sin. Remember, all of our problems started when Eve believed a falsehood. The devil told her that if she ate that forbidden fruit, you will not surely die. But it was a lie. For the wages of sin is always death. Physical death, or the termination of our bodies. Spiritual death, or separation of our spirit from God. Or eternal death, the damnation of our soul forever in the lake of fire. But the wages of sin is always death. And Genesis ends with death, Joseph's death. But here's the good news. Exodus follows Genesis. And though the book of Genesis ends with Israel in Egypt, deliverance is right around the corner. For the book of Exodus, and then the other 64 books that follow, describe for us God's wonderful plan of redemption. And that's what we'll tackle when we come back after Christmas.